I'd like to begin by apologizing a little bit for especially the people who are on the far side. It's the only map that I've got of Jordan, and it's fairly small scale. I'll be pointing to various parts of Jordan, precisely locating sites, but I'll also be saying things like Eastern Jordan, Southeastern Jordan, so maybe if you can't see it very well, at least some indication of what I'm talking about. Tonight's lecture will be in two parts, more or less connected to each other. I'll talk generally about what Jordan has in terms of prehistory, specifying sites, specifying general sections of Jordan, and then I'll have a bunch of slides, which, like I say, are sort of connected with what I'm saying. One of the sets of slides I have is from my excavation last year in near Azraq, which nobody's ever seen before, and you know, I spent a lot of money taking these slides, so tonight you're going to have to go through a little bit of a site report. As David mentioned, the topic will be the roughly 500,000 years of prehistoric cultural development that Jordan has. In a sense, actually, we can start 250,000 years beyond that, almost 750,000 years, in the Jordan Valley, just south, right at the very tip of Lake Tiberias, or the Sea of Galilee. There was a site that was occupied there even before the Jordan Valley was the Jordan Valley. At the time the site was occupied, it was a relatively flat landscape. It was on, in fact, the shore of a much larger lake than Lake Tiberias is today. The people were what are called Homo erectus, at least two major generations back in human ancestry. Fully erect, 2-foot walking people, able to make very effective stone tools. Nevertheless, the stone tools were much cruder than subsequent ancestors to modern human beings made. They were hunting hippopotamus, elephant, a number of smaller animals, as well as apparently taking advantage of the marine life or the aquatic life that lived in the large lake. Sometime after 690,000 BC, we can't say for certain how much after 690,000 BC, the floor of the Jordan Valley literally fell apart. Within 1,000 years at the most, the Jordan Valley went from a nice level thing that it was back then to the deep chasm that it is now, 1,200 feet or more than 300 meters of sudden falling called the Graben Falls. Related, of course, to tectonic movements, that is, the Earth is not as solid as everybody used to think. Africa was moving a little bit to the northeast and opened a big crack or a major area of the Near East to fall into. In Jordan, east of the Jordan Valley, our earliest evidence comes from a site very close to Azraq called, well, it's not a site per se, it's an area in Jebel Uweinat. Jebel Uweinat, for any of you who might have traveled from Azraq Castle to Qadr Amra, is a big volcanic lava-topped hill just to your left as you on your way down to Qadr Amra. Jebel Uweinat is filled with archaeology all the way up through the Neolithic period, but in a wadi just to the southwest of Jebel Uweinat, Randy Old, who is sitting in the office in the audience tonight, and I stumbled across a series of about 30-40 very crudely made hand axes lying in the bottom of the wadi. The reason I say it's not a site per se is because it looks like all of the artifacts have been disturbed severely. They've been moved away from their original place of deposition and have ended up in the wadi. You remember last time I talked about the hard hammer technique and how it produced very jagged edges on some of the stone tools, and that the improvement of using a bone or an antler to to make tools, made the edges less jagged, made the edges, the cutting edges much straighter. Here you can see how jagged the edges are on this piece. Okay, a couple of these. Anyway, that happens just when, April of this year? Until that time, Jordan really did not, east of the Jordan Valley, Jordan did not have anything that looked much older than 150,000 years. Now, perhaps, this site dates back to almost a half a million years. That's kind of exciting, especially for me. I don't know if it's exciting for anybody else. But in one fell swoop now, we've more or less tripled the age of occupation in this part of Jordan. Although we found this material, now we get into a gap in the information. It is not until about 150,000 years BC that we find the next good evidence of human occupation. We might presume that the population in Jordan at a half a million years ago was not very large to begin with, that the number of sites probably was not very numerous. Number wasn't numerous. The number was probably fairly small. We have to consider ourselves very lucky to have found this site, in which it was simply by accident. By about 150,000 to 100,000 years ago, we find an amazing wealth of evidence of human occupation. At the time that these very crude hand axes were made, these are Homo erectus, two major generations back in ancestry. By 150,000 years, now we're talking about Neanderthal man. Neanderthal man must have had a much larger population. At least the number of sites that we find are much more numerous than earlier periods. Part of this, of course, is a lot of the sites were destroyed as well. At Azraq, where I worked last year and will return, I hope, next week, to begin working, there's an amazing collection of artifacts that ended up on the surface of the ground as the result of a digging operation to improve the water at Ain el-Esed. The spring at Ain el-Esed had more or less clogged up with vegetation, dirt had fallen around and became more or less a swamp, and the water was no longer usable for the Bedouin out there who had to water their herds or for even their personal consumption. So a big hole was dug about 5 meters on the side, and on the surface where the dirt was dumped were tremendous numbers of hand axes, beautifully made, well fashioned, and kind of appealingly black as well. If you look right across the tip of that thing, when this came out of the dirt, it was razor sharp. It's been banged around a little bit now in the truck and even in the laboratory upstairs. Very finely made material. All of it came from a very small area of an excavation. Now, people who excavated it were not archaeologists. Thankfully, they told somebody about it, so we were able to find out that the site did exist out there. And what I'm trying to do now at that site is to find the undisturbed layers so I can see the relationship of the tools, hopefully to the bones that might still be preserved, so we can find out what they were hunting out there. Did they prefer rhinoceros to alligator? An alligator, probably not. A large number of questions about why they were there, what they did, and maybe even why they left. Another huge area of occupation at this time is evidence down near Shobak. 2 years ago, Ed Harrell, who used to work for AID here at the embassy, the American embassy, brought in a couple of small stones, and he asked whether or not they were real, that is, were they real stone tools. I looked at them, and they were magnificent pieces of Neanderthal craftsmanship. And it was a circular hand axe, a round hand axe, and a very nice elongated hand axe. And I said, oh, this is beautiful. Where did you find this? So he took me down, and we looked at the thing, and the site was gigantic. It was almost almost 15 acres of hand axes and flake tools and cores. There's an amazing distribution, an amazing piece of evidence of intensive occupation in one small area. 15 acres must have at times turned into a circus down there with that number of people coming back repeatedly to the same place. Late last year, Randy Old again comes to the rescue. We went down to look at the site and the area around the site a little more intensively, and we walked for 15 kilometers approximately from just northwest of Shoback in a semicircular route following the plateau, following the rim of the plateau. And for those 15 kilometers, the number of hand axes, although they changed in density, still appeared all over wherever we walked in a truly amazing set of circumstances. I should probably go into my theory of why so many hand axes were there. And not only at Shoback, but also up here in Yenandra. And to do this, we have to talk about the changing climate that Jordan has undergone for the past half a million years. If you go out to Azeroth today, or even if you go down to Shoback today, you'll notice that the landscape is fairly dry. And of course, for Azeroth, it's a desert out there. Of course, it's dry. Even in Shoback, which receives perhaps 600 millimeters of rain, usually in the wintertime, the landscape is still fairly dry. It's not really a desert, but it certainly would not be considered tropical as well. The phenomenon of the ice ages, which still is not well explained, witnessed a period of advances of ice sheets from the North Pole towards the South, and from the South Pole towards the North, which resulted in the movement of storm tracks. Now, all of us are fairly well aware that the storm tracks that hit Jordan today normally come from the west or the northwest. And doing so, they cross the Mediterranean Sea only in the northeastern corner, where they pick up the moisture from the sea, and they hit the mountains from Lebanon or in Palestine and here in Jordan, where all the rain is dumped immediately. And by the time the storms get over Azeroth, most of the rain has already been dissipated. And that's why it's a desert today. Now, when the ice sheets moved south, they forced the storm tracks south, so that instead of just catching the northeastern corner, it caught the entire length of the Mediterranean Sea. Much more water was in the air, and it increased the amount of rainfall not only in the mountains, but there was a tremendous amount of water left in the air by the time it got to Azeroth, to the point, in fact, that Azeroth was the scene of a vast Pleistocene Ice Age lake, a tremendous lake, five times the size of the Dead Sea. It also occurred down here in Joppar, and there may be smaller they're called pluvial lakes, ice age lakes, in Wadi Bayer and maybe down in the Wadi Rum. Now that explains perhaps why everybody was up at Azeroth. That is, if you're on the lake shore, you're probably going to be around an awful lot of animals that are taking advantage of the increased vegetation out there. It would be a wonderful hunting spot for the black hand axe people. Okay. Now, in Shoback, I think something else is different. Not only did Shoback also receive a greater amount of rainfall at this period of time, concomitant with the increase in rainfall was a decrease in temperature, perhaps as much as 7 degrees centigrade during parts of the ice age, which meant that this area around Shoback in the wintertime must have been the scene of a vast snowfield, so much that the animals which today do not do very much migration back and forth, at that time, with all the snow, with all the ice, probably would have had to have migrated down into the Jordan Valley. Otherwise, it would frozen to death or starved to death. Now, the nice thing about the Shoback area site is, as I said before, it's semicircular, pointing down towards the Jordan Valley or the Wadi Araba to the west, and the semicircular arrangement of the ridge forms, in a sense, a natural track. Now, the animals would come during the fall, come to the ridge, go down into the valley, winter, and then they'd have to come back up again. Now, as we'll see in slides later on, the slopes of these wadis are approximately the same. Yeah, sometimes that way, sometimes this way. Few like that. But the animals then will come up the wadi system. You can see the animals from a long distance. You can see practically mile after mile after mile down into the wadi. You can tell where the animals are going to come up, and you wait there and hide until these poor, exhausted animals have made this very tiring climb, and it's a butcher's holiday. I think this is the reason. I'm going to tell somebody about it later on. I hope they accepted it. It seems to have been a perfect hunting trap in the middle of a major migration route for the animals. Now, the period when hand axes were made, this is from Shoback, by the way, very nicely done. The period when hand axes were made in Jordan lasts from approximately a 500,000 years up until the beginning of the last ice age. Until about 80,000, maybe 75,000 BC. All of this time, we see the change from human ancestors from Homo erectus, the kind of Peking man that existed, to Neanderthal man. And at the beginning of the last ice age, about 75,000 to 80,000, it's still Neanderthal people, but they've stopped making the hand axes. Instead, they're relying now for killing animals, for butchering animals, for processing all of their vegetable foods, the flake tools. Remember, as you're making these tools, you're producing little chips. Well, instead of making a big tool like this, they would just use more of those chips and produce tools from those instead. This is, in Europe, called the Mousterian period. I think it's probably inappropriate to use the term here in Jordan for something that is called way over in Western Europe. I think we have enough of a specialized development over here that we should not call it a French term. A more neutral term would be the Middle Paleolithic, that is, the Middle Old Stone Age. In Palestine, where a tremendous amount of work has been done, especially compared to work here in Jordan, the changes in the Middle Old Stone Age, the Middle Paleolithic, are very well documented. Going through the university, you learn a very well set program of change through time. And it was not until, in fact, I started getting involved in various parts of Jordan that I was getting a little confused over here, because the same patterns of development here in Palestine were not necessarily showing up over here. In fact, I was getting a little frustrated because they didn't fit, you know, what I thought should be happening. To be honest, I have to admit that so far, the Middle Old Stone Age, the Middle Paleolithic, is not well attested here in Jordan. There are very few sites that come from this period. One of the sites is very close to Mabra, called Khanazira. In the Middle Old Stone Age, at Mabra, everything is characterized by more or less round flakes, no hand axes. We have no evidence of projectile points, that is, spear points or whatever. In a sense, it's almost like a boring set of tools. There's nothing that really catches the eye. Tools had to be effective, otherwise people would have died out. But it's a very sort of bland kind of set of stone tool. You'll recall last time that I mentioned something called the Levallois technique. That is pre-shaping the flake on the stone before you remove it. So that once the flake comes off, you've got a perfectly formed tool that you don't have to change the shape of to use. Okay, the Levallois technique. It begins actually during the hand axe period. And at Schoback, there is a tremendous amount of this kind of material, but it really catches favor during the Middle Paleolithic. Now, at Mafraq, there is none. There is no Levallois technique, very strange. At Osbach, there was no, or very, very little, in terms of this prepared flake technique. But here in the Wadi Hasa, where we worked with Herb McDonald last season, we found tremendous numbers of sites, literally hundreds of sites that had all of this nice Levallois prepared flake technique with no hand axes. This means it has to be Middle Paleolithic. Neanderthals down in the southern part of Jordan then are certainly having a heyday down there. In the northern part of Jordan, almost no evidence of this kind of technique. Does this mean that someplace there's a cultural boundary? We don't know. Another admission. There have been no prehistoric surveys in northern Jordan. So maybe it's because we haven't found the evidence yet. It's out there, but we haven't seen it. But right now, I'm sort of operating under a very tenuous conclusion that somewhere in the middle of Jordan, there may have been a cultural boundary where the Neanderthals down here did not go north. Possibility. But we have to wait. The Middle Paleolithic does not actually last very long. If you look at the hand axe period, for example, the lower Paleolithic lasts for almost 2 million years in Africa. In Jordan here, it lasts for almost 500,000 years. It's followed then by the Middle Paleolithic, but the Middle Paleolithic only lasts for about 40,000 years. That is, it was a fairly rapid change compared to the older periods in how people did things, how they made their stone tools, probably, in fact, what they were using the tools for. At about 35,000 BC, we see a major change in how they made their stone tools. It just happens to coincide with the development of fully modern man. Instead of relying on these more or less square or squat, roundish flakes, the revolution comes in the consistent production of these nice, long, parallel, knife-like flakes called blades. Flakes are still made by fully modern man at 35,000 BC. But he certainly relies on this kind of material. The piece I have in my hand actually is Neolithic. We'll get into that a little bit. But you'll notice that one side is very nice and flat, while the other side is nice and sharp. That provided a beautiful cutting tool, beautiful butchering tool, woodworking tool perhaps, an excellent kind of material, and also was more efficient. You could consistently produce these long, narrow pieces. You could consistently produce more of them from a given size of a rock than these big round ones. It was a nice increase in terms of efficiency and economy of using. Now, the change to the Upper Paleolithic, okay, the last part of the Old Stone Age, when modern man first started on the scene, was, in a sense, gradual. That is, they did not drop everything that their ancestors had been doing. One of the best evidences of that is that right at the beginning of the end of it is the production of still Levallois technique flakes. Here we have a Levallois point, probably used as a spear point, but which has been modified slightly at the back where it was struck off. They've made it intentionally thinner, it would have been fairly thick. They made it thinner to make it easier to change was fairly gradual, but actually the change took place within several thousand years. So in another sense, it's very rapid. And then eventually, they don't make anything like we used to in the Middle Paleolithic. The Upper Paleolithic is, in fact, a big question mark in Jordan. And not only in Jordan, but in Saudi Arabia as well. We have evidence of the earliest parts, where they maintain the old Levallois technique, but modify it a little bit, from Wadi al-Hasa. We have five sites with, or four sites, with the earliest part of the but then we get into another huge gap. The evidence, again, might be we haven't looked hard enough for it. I repeat that, you know, northern Jordan simply has not had any surveys looking for those sites. But there have been a lot of surveys in southern Jordan, not a lot, four or five. And whether or not the Upper Paleolithic really exists down there, we can't say for certain. And certainly we get a lot of blades, some magnificent pieces, and here's the stone, the core that those blades came from, especially down here in Jaffa. Jaffa is loaded with this kind of material. Personally, I would guess that this is Upper Paleolithic, but since it's from the surface, we can't say for certain. But it does fill in a gap that changes from the cruder material of the Neanderthal people to the very fine material that's produced near the end of the Ice Age. I say it's Upper Paleolithic, but if you say it's not, I can't argue with you. I really can't prove it. The Jaffa Depression is loaded with this material. So is the Wadi Bayer, where Scott Ralston is doing a survey down there. Sometime we hope we can find a site that's still preserved in situ so we can make some real dating. Maybe we can find some bone so we can radiocarbon date to find out an age. We hope. The Upper Paleolithic, when modern man had already become completely modern, starts to sputter, in a way, near the end of the Ice Age, at about 14,000. We see a gradual change in long blades becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. And then suddenly, at about 14,000 BC, maybe 12,000 BC, it's hard to say, the dates aren't always agreeable, they start to rely on very, very small blades, microliths. Generally, the microliths are made in geometric shapes as triangles, as rectangles, as trapezes, and, or as lunate, semicircular, little bits. Most of them not larger than that, just right around an inch. This heralds the beginning of what's called, in different parts of the world, the Mesolithic, that is sort of the middle, what's wrong with that? The middle age, middle stone age. It's different enough from the Upper Paleolithic because of its reliance on brand new kinds of tools. Yet the techniques that are used to produce them are still more or less the same. So in Europe it's called the Mesolithic, but here I prefer to use the term epi-paleolithic. That is just the absolute final end, sort of a tack on the paleolithic. The reliance on these microliths. Until last year, the number of epi-paleolithic sites, which extend from 14,000 approximately BC to approximately 8,000 or 7,500 BC, up to last year, the number of epipaleolithic sites was almost negligible. There was one down at Beda, very just north of Petra, and one at Jericho. For the rest of the country, it just simply did not exist, as far as our knowledge went. This year now, a Jordanian student of prehistory has been digging up by Harani Castle at the famous flint site of Harani, and he has found not only a magnificent epipaleolithic site called Natufian, based on these microliths. He has also found Jordan's first Natufian burial. In fact, fact, probably has three of them, human beings, and you may have a camel fairy, which would be very, very strange, sort of cultic, perhaps. On the other hand, maybe the camel just fell in a hole. One of the nice things about the burial at Harane is it was laid out, fully extended, the guy lying on his back, and there was one either gazelle or goat horn just to the left of his head, and another one just to the right, as if it were some kind of shaman, perhaps a medicine man, or perhaps he was a very famous hunter of his time, or perhaps he grew horns. But it's an intriguing situation and something that should really pep up people's interest in Georgian prehistory. The Epipaleolithic also witnesses a kind of change in how people lived, that is, what they lived on. During the entire Paleolithic, they were, of course, primarily hunters and gatherers. Not primarily, they were completely hunters and gatherers. For the most part, going after large game, such as wild cattle, wild horse, rhinoceros out in Azrak, they're going after big stuff. But at the end of the Ice Age, things apparently started to change for the worse in terms of the environment. The big game animals were forced out because the countryside became more and more like a desert. So there was no forage for the large animals. Instead, it was the smaller animals like gazelle, wild sheep, and wild goat. The smaller tools may indicate that they're working with smaller things. It's hard to say. It's kind of a simplistic statement, but in Palestine, anyway, we can see that they're beginning to collect wild seeds and eating wild seeds, grinding them with grinding stones. So far, we don't have any evidence for that here in Jordan, but give us time. We'll find it. At the end of the Epipaleolithic, then, we come to the Neolithic. That period of time when human groups no longer had to rely on nature to provide them with food. They begin to grow their own crops and begin to herd their own animals. They don't have to go out hunting as much as they used to. They used to rely on hunting. Now they supplement their hunting with homegrown crops and with homegrown and home-herded animals. Chiefly sheep and goats, especially in the early period, and chiefly emmer wheat, what's the barley? Two-row barley at the beginning, but in relatively rapid times, this is expanded to a larger and larger diet. Cats trying to come in here and become a part of the diet. The best evidence we have now for the farming part of Neolithic is, again, at Beta, where we have the pre-pottery Neolithic, which lasts from about 7,500 to about 6,000 BC. Pre-pottery means that even though they're Neolithic, they do not yet make pottery. They're relying entirely on probably wooden or stone containers, maybe leather containers, for processing and eating their food. At Beta, we also have domestic goat. And certainly the same is true at Jericho, where they have domesticated grains and domesticated goat at the same time. Magnificent sight. Up here on the plateau, the Neolithic takes on a different face. Although there may have been settled, permanent villages up here, so far we don't have the evidence for real farming yet. Again, on Burton McDonald's survey down the Wadi Al-Hasa 2 years ago, he found a magnificent site. Which has, it's been exposed by a road cut, with plastered walls, what looks like a drainage tunnel coming out right next to this building. Perfectly good Neolithic flints and some extremely cruddy ceramics. Next spring, I hope to begin an excavation down there. The site is called Kirbet Hammam because of a hot spring that's just below it. And it should open up quite a necessary new view of what was going on in the Wadi Al-Hasa area in the south during this early part of the Neolithic. That brings us up to 6,000 BC. Actually, we can go a little bit more into that. The Neolithic then continues with the beginning of at first crudely made pottery. It becomes finer and finer, more or less finer and finer. Sometimes the pots are decorated with painting, sometimes not. Overall, compared to the later periods, the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, for example, the pottery is actually pretty crude, but it's still sort of an interesting view of how this begins. Now, farther east during this period, and we're not sure if it's in the early part of the Neolithic or the later part of the Neolithic, we come into some amazing, for me, differences in how these people were living. In the villages, you find everything. Houses, knives, forks. You don't find knives and forks, but you find the domestic kinds of material. A very wide range of stone tools. When they start to make pottery, they have a wide range of pottery styles and types, probably for different functions. In the deserts, the same is absolutely not true. That is, in the deserts, you find sites that are rather bizarre in terms of the kinds of tools you find on them. Here, again, we go up to Harane, up to Jebel Awenid, just west of Azraq, and even farther out into the panhandle part of the desert here, all the way up to H4, whatever that is, are huge numbers of sites, very densely packed with artifacts, and almost all of the tools are of one single type. Something called a burin, which is simply a chisel-like tool or a graving tool to work either on wood or on bone, to make tools out of wood or to make tools out of bone. I've got a couple examples up here. It'd be easier to show you than to try to explain it, but you can come up and take a look at these things. Mujahid Mahaisen, the history student who excavated the Natufian burial, Mujahid and I went out close to Harami Castle, and in 12 and a half meters, we picked up 5,000 flints, very, very dense, and half of those are tools, and 95% of them are this. Now, the site itself is 30 meters in diameter, so based on our calculations, there should be over 100,000 tools, all burin, either for the use in woodworking or in bone working. Now, I don't know how many trees are out there in the middle of the desert. There may have been some. It's right next to a wadi. But I'll tell you one thing. I would have hated to have been a gazelle at the time. They must have been slaughtering them like mad. What they were making out of the bones, we don't know. The bones are all gone. They've been destroyed by natural forces. If there was wood, we would love to find some preserved wood. No wood left at the site. But these sites dot the entire area. It is fantastic. There's so many of them. And then in other parts, you'll find one site like this, maybe 30 meters away or 100 meters away. You'll find another site where it's just the opposite. Again, densely populated with flints, but no tools at all. So this must be they were chipping their tools, taking the tools off, going over to another place, and then using them. And again, a third kind of site is the arrowhead site, where you find a lot of chipping debris, and most of the tools are delightful little arrowheads. So we've got hunting sites, we've got chipping sites, and then these enigmatic, very puzzling, burin sites, the graver sites. We hope. Right now, there's a fairly large survey going on in the area by a British woman named Alison Betts, who works out of the British Institute. I think she has one or two more seasons left. She may be able to provide us with a lot of good information to explain these very strange things. Mujahid and I will continue to work out in the Karami area, hoping we can find some information that will put this material into a better set of circumstances so we can understand what was going on. Now, I think I'm tired of moving back and forth across this map, so we might start the slide. Now, I should warn you, this is more or less a very restricted travel log, but we'll hope that something is fun, if not fun. Okay. I'll try to show you some of the sites, not very many, and some of the artifacts, so you get a better perspective. This is the spring called Ein Elazer, which is about 5 kilometers, or less than that, 2 kilometers south of the village of Azraq Shishan. There's a large Air Force base, the fence of which you can see here. We're right at the southeast corner of the Air Force base at Azraq Shishan. Here is the hole that was dug back in 1958 to make the spring work again, and the hole also acted to store up water so that the Bedouin could use it. They also, you see the huge pump here. They at one time tried an irrigation experiment, which failed. But the pump is very nice because this corner is my fixed datum point. It's the only thing I can use for a datum point. As you can see, standing water, a lot of cane reeds, and some recent tamarisk trees and perhaps some cypress trees. Our trenches, which this must have been taken. Oh, man, isn't that Jody? Yeah, this was taken before we excavated. Oh, I know, I'm sorry, that's a British woman, the Dibogota's car. Okay, we set in our trenches here and another trench right here, a smaller trench. Next. We started on a fairly small scale, of course, with here's a small trench, 1 meter by 2 meters. Next. This was the end of the first week of excavation. We gradually expanded it into a long trench, 11 meters this direction, and 5 meters for this one. This square right in here, right at the intersection, was our deepest square. It went down to bedrock at 3.5 meters deep. When I hit bedrock without finding the hand axes that I thought were going to be all over the place, when I hit bedrock, I became a little sad, of course, but then I also became convinced there was no reason to dig up here and no reason to dig any farther here. So we extended the trench towards the west, thinking that the lake shore, where the Neanderthals lived, would be in this direction. Next. Here you can see how we've extended towards the west. The last square here now is the next deepest square. We didn't have enough time before the money ran out to get down to bedrock, but we did get down to 2.75 meters, well below where the hand axes should have been, according to a very early report. Next slide. You'll notice in that previous slide, these very long and deep trenches. One of the problems out of Azraq is there's always a constant strong wind. Now, of course, all archaeologists have to drink tea, but at least the trenches provided us with a windbreak so we could have our breakfast with very little trouble. Look at this lucky fellow, he's smoking. I'd also like you to look at this square. This is that square at the intersection of the two trenches. If this fellow just happened to roll over and know a fly can't swim, he would have been struggling through 2 meters of water. Okay? Actually, now we're looking straight down into that square. Now, ladders are very expensive in Jordan, so we set up a series of elaborate steps down in the I was going to say dirt, actually, it's the mud itself. Here is the deepest part we ever got. Here I hit bedrock, and I said there's no reason to dig the entire thing, so we just closed the square down. You can see water starting to accumulate. The water came all the way up this high, again, 2 meters deep. Of course, the water and the mud provided quite a sort of frustrating set of circumstances, but thanks to ingenuity and the use of some very sophisticated equipment, we were able to keep up with it. Next. if you dug a little hole, let water collect in there, get the old plastic cup out and throw it into the bucket. Yeah, you gotta say the Vikings really know what they're doing. Next. The second trench was over, as I pointed out, on the west side. It was a smaller trench. Actually, it was only 2 meters long by a meter wide. The Ayatollah Khomeini came over and gave us a little bit of help. Actually, this is Gary Funkhauser, a colleague of mine from the University of Arizona, who was an excellent worker. I wish he'd come back this year, but he's already tied up. You can see also the closer we got to the spring, all of the plant life we had to mess around with. Again, sort of a source of minor frustration, minor irritation. That's okay. Next. We had a lot of visitors at the site. You can't quite see Gary here. You can see Gary's goofa, but Gary is right down here in his little trench. In fact, he's not in the trench at the present time, primarily because of these mean, squalid beasts. All work stopped at the time because they were not only making a tremendous amount of noise, they were also making a tremendous amount of dust, which thankfully didn't come out, and making a tremendous smell as well. Next. You can see, very numerous. There's not so much dust here because it is kind of muddy, but these camels are from Saudi Arabia. Very vicious. Now, I don't know if it's because of their normal personality or if they were just tremendously thirsty, but look, these things are horrible. Next. We had all kinds of animal visitors out there. We had a lot of snakes, one beautiful little crab, a lot of scorpions and stuff. The workmen and the Bedouin love to kill snakes. I shouldn't say that. They detest snakes and they generally kill them. I tried not to have them kill all the snakes until one morning when we came to the site. This snake, it's a water snake, entirely harmless, was in one of the trenches, in the water in one of the trenches. And that was just too much for Ahmad. He decided he didn't care what I thought about snakes, and so he got himself a trophy. Okay? Now, this is what we were looking for in the trench itself. These are these beautiful hand axes, very finely made. If I could flip this up, it would have a very sharp cutting edge, either in this sort of elongated oval shape or a more or less heart-shaped hand axe. These came from the dirt that had been dug in 1958. Okay, it's on the surface. I was looking for the stratum where the undisturbed hand axes were. Next. There's another kind of hand axe called the cleaver. It's the one I held up earlier, where this very sharp, razor sharp edge there would have